My name is Joe Skitsky, and I'm a surgeon here at Roswell. But I also work in the Department of Immunology, and I have an interest in immunotherapy. And so I know that you guys had a lecture a couple weeks ago by Dr. Muhich, where he talked about some immunotherapy with DC vaccines, and also he talked about some checkpoint inhibitors and some of the new medications that are going on there, which is really exciting. But today I'm going to be talking about cellular immunotherapy. And cellular immunotherapy is actually, it's very exciting, but it's actually fairly old. It's been going on since at least the 1970s, but it's actually coming to fruition. And we actually have a cellular core here at Roswell where we're able to generate cells and treat patients with cancer using some of these approaches. So, to start, I'm going to explain the rationale behind cellular adoptive immunotherapy. I'm going to describe some of the methods that are used to actually improve the results. And I'm going to talk about, lastly, some of the mechanisms of why immunotherapy fails. Okay. And so even though we're talking about cellular immunotherapy, and we're kind of talking about, you'll see what I'm talking about, it's outside the body, but this also probably applies to immunotherapies that work within the body itself, so dendritic cell vaccines and checkpoint inhibitors, the same mechanisms probably apply. So just the basics. The immune system, it can be broken down into the innate versus the adaptive. Innate immunity includes your skin, mucosal barriers, anything that prevents bacteria or infection from getting to the underlying tissue. Generic things like complement that are non-specific that can kill bacteria non-specifically, neutrophils, NK cells, mast cells, they all just kill bacteria, fungus, viruses non-specifically. But we have an adaptive part of our immune system, and that's the part that is actually very exquisitely specific. And it's adaptive in that it can change over time. And so when we talk about adaptive immunity, we're usually talking about T-cell mediated immunity or B-cell mediated. And so T-cells come in two flavors, CD4s, which are helper T-cells, and CD8s, which are cytotoxic. CD8s actually require direct contact with the cell, of the target cell to generate cell death. So it has to actually come in direct contact. And the classic example of this is when you have a virus and the virus infects your cell, the CD8 cells can recognize it and kill the cells that are infected with virus. CD4s often produce cytokines that actually are kind of like the generals. They guide the CD8s and tell them where to go and what to do. B cells, we're not going to focus on them, but actually they're becoming more and more recognized as being important for cancer immunotherapy, but we're mostly going to be focusing on T cells. And so there's two strategies. There's active strategies for immunotherapy, and again, you heard some of them about vaccines with dendritic cell vaccines. Active strategies means that it has to rely on the host's response. Okay, so the host has to generate the response. Passive strategies don't necessarily rely on the host. And so cellular immunotherapy that we're going to talk about is actually a passive strategy. We're going to be giving cells, white blood cells, back to the patient so that we're doing all the work outside the body to program these cells and put them back into the patient to attack cancer. So it's kind of a passive process. And so you should recognize now that cancer is a very good immune target. Okay, in the past, people would say you can't have the immune system reject a cancer because cancer comes from self. It's a self cell that goes bad, right? And so they used to make the analogy that trying to treat cancer with your immune system is like trying to reject your right ear while keeping your left. Well, it's actually not true. Cancer is different than self. Even though it comes from the self, it has many mutations. And so all those mutations actually eventually get expressed as proteins. Okay, and those proteins get expressed on the cell surface, and they can act as targets for your immune system. So cancers do have unique antigens. There's evidence that the immune system is very important for cancer because when you're immunosuppressed and when patients have like solid organ transplants, like a kidney transplant or a liver transplant, there are medications that dampen their immune system, and those patients are much more likely to develop a variety of different cancers, leukemia, lymphomas, skin cancers, and others. And so there's this process called immune editing. And this was well described, more recently described in better detail, but in the past, over 100 years ago, it was described as immunosurveillance. And it was the idea that your immune system can identify cancer cells and eliminate them. And so this was taken a couple steps further, and there's lots of actual good data, in terms of preclinical animal data as well as human data, showing that the immune system functions probably about 99% of the time in an elimination phase. Okay, and that's when a cancer cell pops up in your body, and that event happens roughly about 3 times a day for a normal individual. So every day you have about 3 cells that pop up in your body that have the potential to go on to become a cancer or a tumor. Your body is very efficient at recognizing those cells and killing them. Okay, so that's the elimination phase. And again, most of us go through our whole lives through the elimination phase, and it's a very normal process. Cells are exposed to a variety of different mutagens, like UV radiation, cosmic rays, gamma radiation, the toxins in our water, our food. So it's not abnormal for us to pop up with cells that can become cancerous, and the body clears them very efficiently. But what can happen is that if those cells are not cleared, and they kind of exist equally with the immune system, it's kind of what we call an equilibrium phase. So it's not fully forming a tumor, but the immune system is not recognizing it as being a problem. And then what eventually happens is what we see is something called the escape phase. And that's what we see is clinical cancer, okay? That's when a tumor grows, that's when the cancer can spread to other organs, that's when it's in the escape phase. It's completely escaped the immune system, it's no longer in balance with the immune system. And so the idea behind this is that, yes, this is how cancer is most likely to develop. They avoid the elimination phase, they're in equilibrium, and then they escape. But the idea behind immunotherapy is that we want to go from the escape phase back either to the equilibrium phase or optimally to the elimination phase and getting rid of the tumors, the metastases altogether. And so some of the benefits of immunotherapy, they're pretty obvious. It's relatively non-toxic. It's not like chemotherapy or radiation therapy. You're not going to lose your hair. You're not going to be sick. Sometimes you may have flu-like symptoms with some of the immunotherapies, but they're pretty mild for the most part. And it's exquisitely specific, so that, as I mentioned, CD8 T-cells, the T-cells have T-cell receptors that recognize foreign antigens, and they can recognize tumor antigens, and it's very highly specific. These are 8 or 9 peptides that are different than normal peptides that are expressed by tumor and can be recognized directly by these T cells, so it's very specific. And it can be curative. Like I said, the idea is that you go from escape phase and then you can go all the way back to elimination, getting rid of bulky disease. And it's adaptive, it can change over time. So as the tumor is under stress to change and lose antigens, the T cells can adapt and identify new antigens and keep up with the tumor. And that it can offer long-lived protection or memory, so that if these cells were to come back, they can be cleared again by the T cells. And so, immunotherapy for cancer, when we're talking about adoptive immunotherapy, it really goes back to this guy. Does anybody know who this is? He's interesting. So it's Steve Rosenberg. He's the head of the surgery branch at the National Cancer Institute. And he's interesting in that he was a surgery resident a long time ago. And when you're a resident, a physician, you rotate through different areas. And so he was rotating as a second or third year resident at the VA hospital. And they operated on this guy who he had gastric cancer. They opened him up. It was biopsy-proven gastric cancer. It was spread everywhere, so they couldn't really do anything for the guy. They closed him up and sent him on his way. He didn't get any treatment or anything like that. He was at the VA, so he actually just left. And what was interesting was that he came back and rotated 3 years later at the VA, and that patient came back. And they were shocked that the guy was still alive. And the guy was complaining of a hernia from where the incision was. And so they took him back to the OR to fix the hernia, and they took a good look around, and there was no evidence of cancer. So that's what sparked his interest in immunotherapy and the immune system. He saw that this was very profound, that, you know, somebody that had gastric cancer, there's no other explanation other than his immune system took care of it because the guy never received any other treatment. So he dedicated his life to studying immunotherapy. And so he did some of the early studies in the 1970s looking at IL-2, interleukin-2, and treating patients directly with IL-2, but eventually growing cells outside the body and giving them back to the patient. And he's done work in the 80s, 90s, and all the way up to the 2000s. And some of the advantages of his approach by taking cells outside the body and growing them outside the body are that, first of all, it's feasible. He's shown that you can do that. He's done it for over 30-some years, and now other places are doing it, places like Roswell. You can activate and expand these T cells outside the host. So the patient's immune system is, you know, pretty shot already. It's in the escape phase, right? So your immune system is not recognizing it. The tumors are producing lots of things that will make it invisible to the immune system. So by taking the cells outside the body, growing them and generating them outside the body and putting them into huge numbers, you may get away from all the immunosuppressive effects of the tumor in the host. You can generate very large numbers, super physiologic numbers. So he's injecting, you know, tens of billions of cells back into the patients. And when they're outside the body, now we actually have the opportunity to do genetic manipulations of these cells. So we can actually, and I'll show you some of the things that they're doing, but you can actually make them better anti-tumor cells, better cells that can kill tumors, better cells that can get to the tumor sites, cells that will live longer, etc. The problem with this in the past was it was very labor intensive. Now there's some things that have made it a little bit easier, but again, growing cells outside the body and then putting them back into a person is pretty intense. It's very expensive. The cost for an adoptive transfer used to be about $70,000 per adoptive transfer, so, you know, insurance companies are not going to cover it. It's going to be something that's only done in the form of clinical trials. Some people would argue it's very artificial. So growing cells in a plastic petri dish and then putting them back into a person, you know, are those cells actually the best thing to put back into the person? Does it make sense? And the other part is those cells have been growing outside the body. They've been expanding. And so cells can only expand so much. The telomeres get clipped, and then the cells, you know, have to stop expanding. So the cells that go into the body actually may have a very short half-life. They may not live very long. And the other problem with this approach is that there's no off-the-shelf ability. You can't just take cells off the shelf and then give them to somebody. It has to be matched genetically with their HLA type. There's some things that are going on now that are trying to avoid this and work out off-the-shelf applications, but we're not there yet. So these are the advantages. And sorry. These are the advantages. So you can see this is a CAT scan, and basically this is a liver tumor. This is a liver. This is a big tumor in the liver, and you can see after treatment, the tumor goes away. It's kind of like scar tissue. This is a big adrenal mass. The adrenal mass goes away, and what happens is the adrenal gland actually goes back to normal shape. So it's unlike radiation or chemotherapy, where it doesn't destroy the surrounding tissue. It actually can clear the tumor and preserve the surrounding tissue. This is a person that had very bulky lymph nodes, and those lymph nodes went away. This is somebody who had a brain metastasis. So this is in their cerebellum, and this is actually on the brainstem, and this is the cerebrum. And these brain mets went away. So unlike chemotherapy, there's no sanctuary sites. There's no blood-brain barrier that can impede the immune system. There's no blood testing barrier. So the immune cells can go anywhere in the body. So there's no sanctuary. Tumor cells can't just hide in the CNS and get away. And so the results, when you see them, are actually very impressive. Again, this is a melanoma tumor, a very large, bulky disease. And these are people, for the most part, that have failed all other treatments. They've failed chemotherapy, they failed radiation, they failed all other treatments. And yet, they still respond to this adoptive immunotherapy, and the tumor goes completely away. And so, between 1970 and 1980, Rosenberg started these studies. And what he did was he took peripheral blood, a blood sample from a person who had cancer, grew those cells in interleukin 2. And interleukin 2 just basically expands the cells, makes the T cells really rev up and expand. And what he did is he generated these lymphokine activated killer cells, these LAC cells. And later on, they were found to be NK cells. And then he gave them back to the patient through the through the IV route, and also gave them IL-2 exogenously. And he saw clinical responses. He saw that also back in the 1970s and 80s, he saw that if you gave something that knocked down the person's immune system before you gave these cells, they actually did better. Okay, so he gave cyclophosphamide or total body radiation just to knock down the patient's own immune system, and then he saw that these cells, when they're put back into the body, do much better. And so he expanded on this in the 1980s to the 1990s, where rather than using peripheral blood lymphocytes, he thought that maybe we should take the cells, the lymphocytes that actually get into the tumor, and he called these tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. And so what he did is that he took a tumor from somebody who had widespread disease, ground up the tumor, and grew it in IL-2. And what grows out are all the lymphocytes. Okay, so he thought that those lymphocytes were probably more specific for the tumor, that they got to the tumor, they probably were doing something, but maybe they're dampened because of the environment they were in. So he grew them outside the body in huge numbers and then transferred them back in, and the responses he saw were even better. Okay, so these TILs actually were better than the LAC cells that he initially tried, and he also gave IL-2 to help keep them growing while they're in the patient, and they were about 50 to 100 times more effective than LAC cells. And then he got to the point where he was able to grow these cells outside the body and even select the cells, the subclones, that would be most responsive to the tumor and grow up those populations. So he was actually being very selective in the cells that he put back in. And so, again, you can see the responses. This patient had widespread liver metastases. They probably wouldn't even tolerate chemotherapy because their liver function was probably so poor, but when they received immunotherapy, these mets went away. And so, and I'll tell you that the response rates have increased over time, and I'll tell you that some of these patients have actually been cured long-term. And so the question came up, what's the optimal source for T-cells? Is it the peripheral blood? Is it the tumor? Some groups later on, 1990s, looked at tumor-draining lymph node cells or vaccine-prime lymph node cells. And this is something that I was actually a part of in my research at the University of Michigan. I worked for a doctor, Fred Chang, who trained under Rosenberg and took some of the immunotherapy practices to Michigan. And what he did was actually really interesting. So a patient had widespread cancer, usually melanoma. And what he would do is he would take one of the tumors out, he would irradiate the tumor, like grind it up, irradiate it, and then inject it back into the patient. He'd inject it back into the patient's thigh. And about 10 days later, the lymph node would become reactive. And the idea was that that lymph node would be reactive against tumor antigens, it would be reactive against the tumor. He would take out the lymph node and then use that as the source for the T cells, and that's called tumor-draining lymph node cells. And so he would rev them up with anti-CD3, grow them up in IL-2, and then reinfuse them back into the patient. And again, you would see some tremendous responses. So there's two things. I guess I'll talk about this now. The response rates for these have improved steadily over time. And the response rates now, I can approach 70-some percent. Okay, 70-some percent of people will respond to these treatments, but only about 10% will be cured. Okay, so even though from the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and even now, the number still is pretty flat in terms of cures. So the response rates have gone up, but the cure rate remains the same. And it tells me that it's probably more to do with the host than necessarily the cells that we're putting in. But there's two ways that people try to improve the response rates, and these are the two ways that they've been improved. It's by changing the host or the environment first, and then making better T cells. Okay, so by changing the host, we knew that by giving cyclophosphamide or total body radiation, by knocking down the immune system, the patients seem to do better. So they've been going crazy with that, and so you can get something like that would be a desert into a garden. Okay, so changing the host for something that's more favorable for the T cells to live and grow. And then the effector cells, the T cells that you actually generate, these are kind of like the LAC cells. They were very primitive. We didn't know what we were dealing with, but now we can genetically engineer the T cells. We can make them better. soldiers to fight the cancer. So really, it's night and day in terms of how things have gone. And so, looking at the host, immunodepletion prior to doctor transfer, prior to putting in the outside lymphocytes, patients tend to do better. And what it probably does is when you give cyclophosphamide or if you give radiation, it knocks down the patient's own immune cells and eliminates competition for cytokines. So the cells that you're putting in will have more cytokines available, they'll be able to grow, they'll be able to live longer. It probably also eliminates some suppressor cells that dampen immune responses. And believe it or not, dendritic cells actually tolerate radiation and chemotherapy very well, and they actually become more mature. So they actually present antigen better once they're exposed to some of these toxic agents. And then also, radiation has been known to increase tumor antigen display. So the tumors themselves start popping up with neoantigens and more targets for the immune system. So this is a classic protocol, and this is something that would be done here at Roswell, where cyclophosphamide is given and fludarabine. These are two chemotherapy agents that knock down the patient's immune system, and then they do a doctor transfer, and the results are improved. So this is what would happen if you did a doctor transfer without doing immunosuppression. You have immature dendritic cells. They're not able to help the T cells that you put in. The T cells that you put in are competing against all the endogenous cells for cytokines, especially IL-2, 7, and 15, which are very important for maintaining these cells. And basically, the cell can get to the tumor and there's very little tumor kill. Okay, but if you knock down the immune system first with what we call non-myeloablative preconditioning, and that's where you knock down the cells in the periphery but not the bone marrow, DC mature, they can help the T cells that you put in. The T cells have less competition for cytokines, there's more cytokine available, and it can kill more tumor. And now, what Rosenberg has done in the NCI is taken a step further, and it's actually pretty dangerous, but it has improved response rates significantly. They do myeloablative preconditioning. And so they knock out the entire patient's immune system and bone marrow. So to do that, they have to actually take a sample of their marrow to rescue them afterwards. So they have to take out CD34 positive cells, which are stem cells, so they can reconstitute their bone marrow so they can make red blood cells, platelets, and white blood cells. But what they do is they give whole body radiation and high doses of chemo to knock out the entire immune system. They do their doctor transfer, and they're seeing like much better responses against the tumor. And so there's a ton of cytokines available. There's no competition for these guys, and they can do their job. So again, it's more effective, but it could be dangerous. If the patient does not reconstitute their bone marrow, they could die. And so that's what we've done, what the field has done to change the host. In order to change the soldier, or the T cells that we're putting in, they've been doing some genetic engineering. And now genetic engineering is actually very easy outside the body, outside in vitro culture. And so, as Dr. Muhich probably told you a couple of weeks ago, T cells have co-stimulation signals that are very important that tell it to either turn on or turn off. And some of these co-stimulatory molecules really have a profound impact on how the T cell is going to behave, and if it's going to attack the tumor or not going to attack the tumor, if it's going to be tolerant or not tolerant. And so what we can do, and we know this for a fact, that tumor cells by themselves, they often lose MHC class 1 antigen display, so they kind of shed anything that makes them visible to the immune system. We know that they don't have any co-stimulation, for sure. They don't want to have any co-stimulation that's going to cause them to be attacked. So when the T cell gets there, it may not be able to interact with the tumor cell because, again, it's lost its antigen expression, or potentially there's no co-stimulation, so the T cell may not respond against the cancer cell. So what people have been doing is they've been putting in these chimeric antigen receptors, okay? And so what they are, it's basically an antibody domain, okay? So it's a variable fragment, the FAB fragment of an antibody, and it's transmembrane. So this is outside the T-cell membrane, and then inside the membrane, they put these co-stimulatory molecules that will turn on the T-cell to make it attack the tumor cells. And so they make these constructs, and you can put anti-CD3, 4-1BB, CD28, you could put PD-1, you could put things that will block CTLA-4. And so a lot of these co-stimulatory molecules no longer depends on the tumor to express MHC class 1. It doesn't depend on the tumor to express co-stimulatory signals. They can kill very effectively. And these CARs, these chimeric antigen receptor cells, have been used clinically and are actually becoming very useful for leukemias and lymphomas. Okay, so that's they're actually becoming one of the last-ditch efforts before bone marrow transplant. People have been using CAR therapy, and it actually has been very effective. And so what happens is, instead of having the T-cell receptor and all these co-stim molecules, which are not going to be activated in the tumor microenvironment, you now have these CARs, these chimeric antigen receptors, that can recognize antigen and then stimulate the T-cell directly. And so you can have efficient tumor cell killing. And so the more co-stimulatory molecules you put in, the better these T cells seem to do. They're very artificial, but they actually work very well. And so some other methods of engineering T cells, one of the things that actually is done here at Roswell is that the samples, the lymphocytes that are grown outside the body are taken from the peripheral blood, okay? So most of them don't have any anti-tumor activity. They're just regular lymphocytes just floating around. But what they can do is you can actually grow those cells outside the body and then put your own T-cell receptor into those T-cells, so that if you know that the tumor has a certain antigen, like NY-ESO-1, which is a common antigen for some cancers, you can put a T-cell receptor that recognizes NY-ESO-1 into those T-cells and then grow them up into huge numbers and reinject them back into the patient. And so that's one of the things that's happening here. You can do some of these CAR T-cells that we talked about, and then some people are actually doing these hybrid molecules where you can generate a response in a xenograft, a mouse, for example, where it's going to generate a very high and very specific MHC class 1 against the tumor antigen. And then you can actually copy that genetically and make it human, humanize it, and have it as a T-cell receptor so that it's actually very high avidity, high specificity, and again, it leads to better tumor cell killing. So basically, the things that have happened over the course of the last few decades, especially the last 10 years, immunotherapy has tried to generate better T cells. So they take tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, they grow out the T cells, they may select the T cells that are best in terms of their anti-tumor specificity, grow those into huge numbers, and then before they infuse them back into the patient, they can give them chemotherapy or radiation therapy to knock down the host immune system, and these cells actually work a lot better. And so, it's not limited only to CD8 T cells. Actually, people have done this with CD4 T cells. They've done it with non-classical T cells, NK T cells. They've done it with gamma delta T cells. So it's not only limited to CD8. So there are a variety of different cocktails that you can grow these cells in that may make them better effectors. There's cocktails you can grow them in that will make them live longer, for example. And so it's not only CD8s, but for the most part, most of the research has focused on CD8s. And so when I talked about the response rates, the response rates back in the 90s was about 34% with TIL. When they started doing this immunodepletion, it was about 49%, so half of people would show an objective response. But now when they do this total body radiation and do this mild later preconditioning, 72% of people will respond. But again, the cure rate for all of these groups is only still about 10%. The numbers are low, but again, it's people who have failed all other treatments. And so why does immunotherapy fail? It's interesting that it works in 10%, but the other 90%, why does it fail? And so it's most likely related to a variety of factors, and one of them for sure is poor antigen display by the tumor. So if a tumor is expressing antigen that makes it susceptible to the immune system, one of the things that's going to happen is that tumor is going to lose that antigen very quickly. It's not going to, it's going to lose it just based off of selection pressure. It's kind of like a mini version of evolution and natural selection. So it's going to, you know, want to survive. It's going to lose anything that makes it visible to the immune system. So antigen loss is real. The tumor microenvironment is very hostile. So it does not allow these CD8 T cells to live or be happy in the microenvironment. The environment, again, doesn't have co-stimulation, so it induces tolerance. So the tumor just is able to grow and not be recognized. The tumors actually also generate regulatory T cells or suppressor T cells so that it dampens any other immune responses. The number of cells that we put in, they may not be enough, and they may not persist long enough to have a good, have a complete cure. And then the inability of these lymphocytes to actually get into the tumor is probably a major roadblock that has been underappreciated for a long time, but I think it's now coming to the forefront. So antigen loss, this is an example of a study that was done by Rosenberg, and it was a woman, a young woman, who had sequential adoptive transfers. Okay, she had melanoma. She was 27 years old, had a melanoma of the eyelid. It was removed. The appropriate treatment was done. This was in 1999. And she wound up having a positive lymph node, so they removed all the lymph nodes in the area. They actually were very aggressive with her. They gave her radiation, and they tried to give her treatment to try to prevent the melanoma from coming back. Unfortunately, a year later, it came back. I'm sorry, 2 years later, it came back. And she was referred to the NCI because she exhausted all state-of-the-art treatments. And so this is what she looked like. And she was given, the first thing they did for her was that they gave her a vaccine called GP100. Okay, so all this stuff is melanoma. It's all just black tumors. It's all in the lymph nodes and the soft tissue of the neck here. This is her chin. This is her ear. And so melanomas express GP100. Okay, it's a very common protein that they express. And so what they did is they tried to stimulate an immune response against GP100, and they gave her IL-2. And basically, she had no response. So then they started doing adoptive transfers. That's where they generated lymphocytes. The first time, they got them from her peripheral blood. And they grew them up, and they grew cells that were reactive against GP100. And they did the immunodepletion, the chemo and the radiation prior to giving these cells. Then they injected 1 times 10 to the 10th cells, IV. And she had minimal response. These tumors are still growing. Then, what they did is they did a second and a third treatment, but this time, rather than using the cells from the bloodstream, they also used cells that they isolated from the tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. And these were reactive against 2 melanoma proteins, and they grew these cells up in high numbers, and they injected even more, 4 times as much as they did the first time. And the response was a little bit better. And then, what they did was that they had, again, 2 sources of TIL, 2 sources of lymphocytes, PBL and TIL. They were reactive against 2 different antigens. They did immunodepletion, and instead of injecting the cells intravenously, they injected them intraarterially because they thought that maybe the trafficking was important. Maybe they need to get to the tumor better. And the response was actually much better. Okay, so this is as good as she got. It was much improved. But unfortunately, she was going under the 5th treatment. Same thing, they injected similar number of cells intraarterially, but this time there was no response. The tumor just kept growing. And then they biopsied the tumor, and they showed that there was a single point mutation and a loss of HLA2 antigen, so that it was no longer reactive against the natural GP100. There was one little mutation, one little amino acid switch, and the T cell can no longer recognize the cancer. And so remember when I showed you that picture of the T-cell receptor and the antigen, those 8 or 9 peptides? One little switch is exquisitely specific, and it will no longer recognize that mutation. And so her tumor progressed, and she actually died of her disease about 2 years after all of the immunotherapy started. So the reality is that she's received 5 adoptive transfers, IL-2 immunotherapy, vaccine therapy. The cost of that treatment was probably at least $1 million to $2 million, and it was non-curative. So you can imagine how expensive these treatments can be, and so we're still not there yet if we're only curing 10% of people. And so another reason why the immunotherapy fails, especially adoptive immunotherapy, is that it's a very hostile tumor microenvironment. Okay, so there's lots of stuff in the tumor that's going to dampen the immune response. There's lots of adenosine, and adenosine actually dampens immune responses. IDO, which is indolamine 2,3-dioxygenase, is an enzyme which actually dampens immune responses and creates tolerance. The tumor environment is hypoxic. T cells don't do very well. Actually, they get nitrosylated in that environment so that the T cell receptor gets nitrosylated. It's actually bent so that it can't actually recognize properly. And it's an acidotic environment, and there's no co-stimulation or cytokines. Once that T cell gets there, it's a very hostile environment. So adenosine, I'm just going to go over this fairly quickly. Adenosine is the breakdown product of nucleotidases, so ATP, right? ATP outside the body, outside the cell, gets broken down into ADP, AMP, and then adenosine. And so adenosine, when it's floating around in the microenvironment, it dampens immune responses. And that's actually a good thing, because when you're injured, so if you had, say, you got hit with a baseball or something, and you had a big bruise and you had some cell damage to your muscles, you would not want your immune system to react against that damaged muscles and attack your, have autoimmunity attacking your muscles. So there's adenosine that's floating in that environment. It dampens the immune responses. So it's very important naturally. But tumors take advantage of it because they produce a lot of adenosine in the environment, and there are these specific receptors on T cells that actually can recognize adenosine. And the one in particular is the A2A receptor on T cells. And so what happens is that when adenosine is present, it binds to this receptor on T cells and it inhibits activation and expansion of the T cells. So it just shuts them down. And this leads to something called the Hellstrom paradox. And this is like an old idea, but it's been known for many years, that if you looked in the bloodstream of patients that have cancer, their T cells often will react to the cancer outside the body. If you put them in a petri dish, you'll see that the T cells react. But for some reason, they don't react when they're in the body. Okay, so they're shut down. And this is probably the reason why, because of adenosine and some other factors. And again, it's normally a protective mechanism so that you don't induce a lot of autoimmunity. And so this is the A2A receptor. It's very specific. It's a G protein mediated receptor. And what happens is when it's bound with adenosine, it's able to block T cell activation through the T cell receptor. So it blocks signaling through this. And then it also blocks signaling through the IL-2 receptor, so the cells can't expand. Okay. Remember, if you give IL-2, T cells really expand in the big numbers. But if adenosine is present, it blocks both of these, so that the cell just sits there and it can't expand and it can't do anything. So that's a very powerful way that tumors overcome the immune system. And so T-rays can catalyze adenosine. There's lots of things in the cancer cells themselves can catalyze ATP and make adenosine and pump it out into the environment. But what's interesting about this is that adenosine is receptor mediated, right? So if it has to bind to the A2A receptor on the T cell to be inhibitory, that actually opens it up to being able to be blocked, right? You can block that receptor and maybe not have the negative effects of adenosine. And so the effects of adenosine are receptor mediated, so you can give something like this that blocks the A2A receptor and prevents some of the bad effects that the tumor has on the T cell. Does anybody know what this is? I bet that 90% of you had some of this in your system today. You guys like Tim Hortons, Dunkin' Donuts, Starbucks, Spot Coffee. So this is caffeine. And caffeine, in physiologic doses, actually blocks the A2A receptor. So caffeine is interesting in that it may actually promote some immune responses and may actually help T cells in a hostile microenvironment. So I usually don't drink caffeine, but I started to. And I don't know if it's good or bad. And so the other way that tumors kind of become invisible to the immune system is through this enzyme that they produce called IDO. And IDO metabolizes tryptophan, and tryptophan is a necessary amino acid. It helps you make neurotransmitters. The most common neurotransmitter that tryptophan makes is what? Do you guys know? It's involved with, it's linked to depression. There's a drug they treat called SSRIs, selective serotonin receptor inhibitors. So tryptophan gets converted to serotonin in the brain and acts as a neurotransmitter. And what's interesting is that IDO is produced not only at the tumor site, but also in the draining lymph node. And normally, what happens is that it's a feedback mechanism, so that when dendritic cells produce gamma interferon, it's kind of a feedback loop. IDO is produced and it shuts down the immune response. But it's a major mechanism of T regulatory cells or T suppressor cells. And so what happens is that the tryptophan that your body has gets converted by IDO, by the tumor cells, into kynurin and a bunch of other breakdown products. Kynurin by itself is immunosuppressive to the T cell. It's toxic, okay? And so what also happens is that the tryptophan is getting eaten up by the IDO that's produced by the tumor cells, so that less of it gets converted to serotonin. And so what's very interesting about this is that some cancer patients, one of the presenting symptoms is, before they even know they have a cancer, is that, for example, pancreatic cancer, which is very strong with IDO, 10% of patients with pancreatic cancer present with clinical depression. And so it may be related to a drop in serotonin levels as it's being funneled into this this pathway. The other place that IDO is very important, and this is how it was originally discovered, was actually in the placenta. So the placenta produces a ton of IDO, and that's what dampens the immune response for pregnant women, so they don't reject the fetus as being foreign antigen. So tumor mechanisms have adapted IDO, and they've co-opted it, I should say, in terms of using it to remain invisible to the immune system. And so the way that it works, again, it's usually a feedback mechanism for dendritic cells after gamma release. But what can happen is that the IDO by itself can induce T regulatory cells, and these T reg cells actually makes more IDO and converts more dendritic cells into, tolerant DC. So it's like kind of like a double negative effect. It not only produces cells that are tolerant, but those tolerant cells can tag other cells and make them tolerant as well. There are some drugs now that are available to block IDO, and they're in clinical trials. One of them is 1-MT, and that's been used for multiple myeloma. There have been clinical trials, but there's some new IDO blockers that are being used, and some of them are actually being used in combination with some of the newer immunotherapies. So this is a mechanism, you don't have to know this, but it is very interesting. And to my mind, I think this is very unique. It's one of the few mechanisms that's been worked out that, so tryptophan has a specific transfer RNA, right? If your tryptophan is low in the microenvironment, these tRNAs they're not coupled to tryptophan, right? So an empty tRNA for tryptophan is actually the signal for the nucleus to actually increase this or decrease this IDO expression. So it's very interesting in that it's empty tryptophan that would cause, that's linked to the signaling. And so it's a unique mechanism, but again, you don't have to know that. And again, what it does is it increases T regulatory cells, decreases effector T cell proliferation, and increases effector T cell apoptosis. It's a feed-forward mechanism, like I said. Not only does it generate cells that are tolerant, but it actually can tag other cells and make them tolerant as well. And so if you can get rid of these T-regs or block IDO, there's been evidence that it has benefit prior to doing an adoptive transfer. All right, and another way that a tumor avoids the immune system, and especially the adoptive immunotherapy, is senescence. The T cells that we're putting in have been growing in a culture plate. Remember, Rosenberg put in 4×10^10 cells, so those cells were growing outside the body. Their telomeres are going to be very short. So when they go into the body, they only can divide maybe one or two more times. And so they're very old cells that we're putting in. And so they may not be persistent. They may not last very long. And so one of the things that people have been looking at is actually putting telomeres back into the T cells, or trying to make them immortal. And so what would you call an immortal white blood cell? Would it be a good thing or a bad thing? Could be potentially a bad thing, and we would call it leukemia. So if a T cell had unchecked replicative capacity, that's actually the definition of leukemia. Genetically engineering these cells is a good thing in trying to make them have better anti-tumor responses, but it could be a very bad thing if we were to have, give the patient back T cells that had unchecked replication. So what people actually do is they make these cells, but they actually put a lot of, they put suicide genes into these, so they'll be reactive to something that's unique, something like tetracycline. A tetracycline switch is a very common one, so that if the patient did have the T cells took off and were unchecked in their proliferation or growth, you could potentially give them something like tetracycline. It would turn on the suicide gene, and those cells would die. So people have been looking at trying to increase the replicative capacity of these cells by adding telomeres, but also maybe putting in cells that are a little bit less differentiated, maybe more kind of stem cells. And then is younger better? There's a lot of pros and cons of giving fully differentiated cells versus much younger cells. And again, the telomere length tells you how persistent those cells are going to be. So the more telomeres they have, the more ability they have to divide and actually stay in the body. And then I'm not going to get into this, but there's something called sheltering, which is a protein that protects the telomeres. People have been looking at putting that into the T cells as well to try to keep them a little bit longer active. And then again, they've been trying to create these immortal T cells, but that also can be very dangerous, so they've been putting these suicide genes into these cells. And then the last thing I'm going to talk about is limited trafficking into the tumor. And so this is something that I'm personally very interested in, something that my lab looks at, and something that we've looked at clinically. And so you can have the best weapon, the best tank, the best T cell, but if you don't have a good road for it to go into the tumor, it's not going to get there. And so cell-mediated killing requires direct contact. Remember I said the CD8 T cell has to come in direct contact with its target. So it has to come in direct contact with the tumor cell for it to kill the tumor cell. And tumor vessels are grossly abnormal. They're bizarre in their architecture, bizarre in their shape. Normal physiological mechanisms of lymphocyte trafficking are nearly impossible. So these are healthy vessels. There's a very normal, orderly branching pattern, very progressive, going from larger diameter to smaller diameter over generation of vessels. But this is a tumor vessel, very unorganized, very chaotic, corkscrew, very tortuous, lots of differences, high interstitial pressure, lack of a basement membrane. It's bizarre, okay? And so when you think about lymphocytes, they have to follow a certain program. They have to roll against the wall, that's through selectins. They get activated by chemokine receptors, and then they go into the tissue. It has to happen all the time. That's the only way that lymphocytes can get into tissue. They have to go through the sequence of events. Okay, and interestingly, it's analogous to a car going 500 miles an hour and coming to a complete stop in 6 feet. Okay, so that's what's happening with the lymphocyte when it gets into the tissue. It's going through the bloodstream, zipping through 500 miles an hour, and then it gets caught and stops. And that's literally, for the size represented, would be like a car stopping within 6 feet. And then it will get into the tissue. So that's exactly how it happens with the DOFA transfers. These are DOFA transferred cells. This is a melanoma. This is actually, you can barely see it, but this is a blood vessel. This is a blood vessel wall here, and so the lymphocytes get in through the blood vessel, and it's kind of an unfair unfair match, because there's only, you can see two cells here, the adoptively transferred T cells, but then you see basically, you know, 100 melanoma cells surrounding it. So the average is actually about one T cell gets in for about every 10,000 tumor cells. So again, the blood vessels really limit the amounts of access to the tumor. The T cells just can't get there. And so one of the ways that we study this, which I think is really neat, is intraviolet microscopy. And that's living microscopy. It's a microscopic examination of living tissue, and you can actually see in animals, you can see the tumor, you can see the blood vessels, and you can actually label your T cells and watch how they interact with the tumor vasculature. And you can do things to the tumor to try to promote trafficking. You can do things to work out the mechanisms of how trafficking actually happens. It's a very valuable tool. And so we have an IBM microscope in the lab. This is Dr. Evans' lab in the immunology department. And we do animal studies. And you can see the animals here. It's anesthetized. This is digitally recorded. You can actually see the vessels here. These are blood vessels. They're looking at a tumor in the mouse. And we actually can inject through the tail vein. We put a catheter in, inject through the tail vein, and we can actually watch the lymphocytes interact with the tumor. I'm sorry, these are actually movies. I'm going to try to show you. So this is a mouse lymph node, and as you can see, the lymph node is normal. It has a very normal, predictable branching pattern, larger vessels going into smaller vessels. It kind of looks like a tree or a shrub. And the vessels are dark, okay, because there's red blood cell in there that's soaking up the light, so it's contrasted with the rest of the tissue. And then you see these white, bright white dots. These are actually labeled T cells. They're fluorescently labeled. And as you'll see, they interact as they flow through. Some of them are rolling on the sides of the wall, they're slowing down, some of them are stuck to the sides. And this is a very efficient process in the lymph node. This is how the lymphocytes get in and out of the tissue. And so what's interesting is that when you look at a lymph node, oftentimes you see it as just sheets of cells. But if you were looking at it live, it's very dynamic. It's like a beehive of activity. The cells are actually moving all around and like very vigorously moving around. And so this is just showing that it's a very efficient process. Lots of cells are sticking. Eventually they'll get into the tissue. And this is very different than a tumor. And so this is a mouse tumor. And as you can see, the diameter of the vessels are different. There's no true branching pattern. There's kind of a curvy, tortuous nature to them. It does not look like an organized tree or a shrub or something like that. And as we inject the cells, these white blood cells, you can sort of see them. They're the bright white dots. They're moving through, but very few of them are interacting. And the blood flow is much more sluggish than it was in the lymph node. And if you look closely, you'll see that the cells are going in this direction, okay? And there's very few interactions. But if you keep watching, all of a sudden, the direction of flow stops going this way, and now it's starting to go this way. So there's no rhyme or reason to the blood flow in the tumor. And to think that the adoptively transferred cells are going to get there, it's actually, this is a major barrier to how you know, the tumors overcome the immune system. And not only adoptively transferred immune system, immune therapies, but also endogenous immune therapies. So this is also a major barrier for things like PD-1 therapy and CTLA-4 therapy. Um, in closing, I guess this is also a picture that I think says a lot. This is after you do an adoptive transfer. You can label the cells, and this is an animal model, a mouse model. The mouse has lung metastases. These are tumor cells in the lung, okay? And this is low power, and this is high power. And this is after 1 hour, after you put the cells in IV. Most of the cells get trapped in the lung. The dark cells are the adoptive transferred CD8 T cells. And you can see that they're trapped in the capillaries, and they're right next to the tumor. But they don't go directly into the tumor. They actually have to follow the same way that all lymphocytes have to go through the same paradigm, the same adhesion cascade. So what happens is the cells start clearing out, they start getting into the bloodstream, they start crossing over into the bloodstream. And then only when you start seeing them in the bloodstream, then you start seeing them into the tumor deposits. And by 24 hours, it's completely cleared out of the lung capillaries, and then the Doppler transferred cells are all just involved with the tumor cells. So again, even though they're right next to it, they have to go through the bloodstream and go through the same adhesion cascade. And so you can actually dissect out what's important for the adhesion of these cells and maybe even select those cells that have the best adhesion properties. And so these mice were treated exactly the same. They had the same tumor put into them, the same T cells put into them 7 days later. The only difference between these mice are that these mice do not have PNE selected. So the lymphocytes can't go through the adhesion cascade. And so these mice have huge tumors while these mice were cured. So again, trafficking is really important. And so why does it fail? For all of these reasons. But again, I think trafficking is pretty significant, even for other immunotherapies that we do. Okay, that was pretty brief, but that's it. Do you have any questions? I have a question. Do you guys think cancer will be cured? Raise your hand if you think cancer will be cured in your lifetime or next generation. One, two, three. Okay. Yeah, that's actually three more than ever before. So I think if it does happen, it probably will be through the immune system. And so I'll share my last few thoughts with you guys. That it sounded crazy about 10 years ago, but I honestly, more than 10 years ago now, but I honestly believed it. It was about 15 years ago. And the immune system can be the cure for cancer. And cancer, actually, when I talked about it earlier with all those mutations and all that, there's lots of targets for the immune system. When I talked about the elimination phase, that it's normal to develop potentially cancerous cells three times a day you have cells that develop. That's a normal part of living, right? The abnormal part is the immune system not recognizing it anymore. So I think that most people would, in the past they would argue that's crazy, but now I think they're seeing the proof of it with all the immunotherapies that are coming out that are very effective. The cancer is actually not a disease of the cancer cell itself. It's actually probably an immune system defect, okay? So that it's a normal process to develop cancerous cells and mutations and all that. What's abnormal is for it to go unchecked, okay? So that actually targeting the immune system offers the best chance at a cure and actually offers the best chance for responses that we're seeing right now. And these new drugs are absolutely amazing in the clinic. Patients that had no options are getting these treatments that are non-toxic and it's curative. So I think that's my two cents, but I think everything is immune mediated. All right, any other questions, anything else?